Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another great episode we have here of Suspense Radio. I am your host, John Robb, and I want to thank you all for joining us. We have a great show for you today, 2 hours long. There is one thing that I do want to say before we do start the show, and I do know that we all live in a world of fiction with our books and our thrillers and our suspense, but there is a real world out there that is far more dangerous than the world that we live in right now. And Suspense Radio, Suspense Magazine, the whole staff, our hearts go out to the victims, the friends, the family, everybody involved in the horrific, disgusting act that happened in Aurora, Colorado, and the movie theater for Batman past midnight. And I just wanted to let everybody know that, you know, like I said, while we live in the world of fiction, the world of reality is far more frightening. And so, therefore, I just wanted to say that, and hope everybody who's listening, we have a lot of authors that live in Denver in the area, that I hope everybody is good, and you know, no one was affected, but that way. So just wanted to make that mention. But right now, we are going to have 2 hours of Suspense Radio, and it all begins right now. Everybody, welcome back to our two-hour-long episode of Suspense Radio. We've been off for a little bit, and now we're back. We'll be back next week also with a fabulous, terrific show. Tess Garrison, Boyd Morrison, John Land is going to be on that show. So please tune in next Saturday also. But right now, we want to introduce our first guest. She is the author of the latest book, Hell or High Water. Her name is Joy Castro. Joy, we want to welcome you to the show. How are you doing today?
Great. Thank you so much. I'm excited to be here with you.
Well, yes. So Hell or High Water is your debut book.
Yes.
And it just came out.
Yes.
So tell everybody a little bit about Hell or High Water, because you set this in a post-Katrina New Orleans, as people might know. You know, Katrina was the hurricane who literally almost destroyed New Orleans. And so you decided to set it in kind of a post-Katrina New Orleans and a thriller. So tell everybody a little bit about the book and, you know, the conception behind the scene stuff.
Yeah, sure. Well, Hell or High Water is rooted in fact that during the Katrina evacuation, over 1,300 registered sex offenders went off the grid. And it's a fact that in the spring of 2008, when the novel is set, about 800 of those sex offenders had never been relocated. So during that moment in 2008, when New Orleans is still really struggling with the aftermath of the storm, my fictional protagonist NOLA, she's named after the city. She's a reporter at the Times-Picayune, which, as you know, had been doing some amazing journalism during and after the storm. And she gets assigned to the story of these sex offenders and where they've gone, what has happened to them, what's happened to the city in that regard. And so she starts tracking that story. At the same time, a young tourist who looks, interestingly enough, like NOLA, has been abducted from the French Quarter. She was sitting at breakfast with the family that she was working for as an au pair, and she's abducted. She gets up to go to the restroom, and she's not seen again. And so NOLA starts trying to investigate that story as well. And this story is her first big break, and so she's trying to do really well, and it's a scary kind of thing to be investigating. Rapists and murderers and pedophiles and so on, and she's trying to prove herself, so she gets into some risky situations.
Now, when you decided to have the conception for the book, was there something that you read specifically, I guess, about, you know, the sex offenders that went off the grid? Because, of course, I don't think that's something that was, like, in the normal CNN, you know, Fox News kind of reporting. Was there something that, you know, you had read during the research of Katrina and the post-Katrina, the New Orleans, on how all that was set up that drew you in to say, wow, this would be, like, a good setting, you know, for a book?
Sure, and you're right. I mean, it was a small story at the time. My husband grew up on the North Shore of Lake Pontchartrain and then went to college and worked in the city proper. And so I had been traveling to the city for about 20 years with him. And when Katrina happened, his parents evacuated, and they came to stay with us for a while, and we were all watching the coverage fairly obsessively and continued to do so even after it was safe for them to go back home. And so it was a small story, and I don't think it was a big splashy national story at first. Well, you know, maybe ever really, but it was something that caught my attention. I was interested in it, and I thought, you know, that's intriguing. So that's where the germ of the novel began, yeah.
And when you're sitting there and you're kind of writing, and you're writing about, you know, always a subject matter, because whenever you talk about registered sex offenders, you know, it brings up a lot of things. And just more recently, of course, with the Penn State scandal and everything that was going on with the Jerry Sandusky case, do you find that it's kind of a difficult subject matter to kind of wrap your hands around, just because it is one of those, you know, horrific crimes that a lot of, you know, most everybody just can't seem to fathom why somebody would do something like that, especially to children. Did you kind of feel that way when you started to write the book?
I did a lot of research to help wrap my head around it. And, of course, when we talk about Sandusky and Penn State, or we talk about other really horrific crimes, that's only one kind of sex offender, and it's such a complicated issue because some people who are registered sex offenders are not really predators at all. You know, they do, you know, they've done some minor sexual crime that gets them on the offense registry. And so the question of their civil rights, you know, is an open one, too. You know, society figures out what we really want to do with this spectrum of people, some of whom are not unsafe. You know, they're not unsafe. They're not a threat to other people. And some of whom, of course, are very dangerous and predators and will keep offending unless they are stopped. So I did a lot of library research. I had the help of some great research librarians to learn about the facts and the statistics and recidivism rates and rehabilitation methods and what works and what doesn't seem to. So it's really an interesting issue, a very complicated issue, and I did do, you know, have a lot of help with the research because, as you say, it's hard to kind of get your head around it all. And, as you say, it does provoke pretty intense responses in people, and I let the characters in the novel have those responses, you know, those really intense responses of anger or fear, disgust, compassion. There's a broad variety of responses to this issue.
Absolutely, and that, and I want to remind everybody that we're speaking here with author Joy Castro. Her website is joycastro.com, and the book is Hell or High Water. And the other thing is when, you know, whenever I like, you know, you always look at the main character, and your main character, Nola Cespedes, I'm probably saying it wrong.
Oh, sure, Cespedes. Cespedes. It's a Cuban name.
Okay.
Yeah. Cespedes.
So,
yeah.
When you're kind of creating a character, you know, to kind of wrap everything up and around and whatnot, what is like your process to try to, you know, slowly introduce the character to the fans? You know, do you kind of have a way that when you started to, you know, put the book into motion, that you had a way how you wanted to have the character? Because it sounds like that you had the idea of the book first, and then you started to have to wrap your characters within it. Is that something that, you know, is that kind of how your process works?
Well, I love this character. I love Nola Cespedes, and she's really the hinge, the pivot on which the whole book rests. She's very complicated and very conflicted. And so she was always a key ingredient. The concept, you know, was intriguing to me and fascinating, but I knew that at the heart of it, I wanted to have a protagonist that people could really click with. And I think she's just complicated and human enough for that to happen. She was raised in the Desire Projects in New Orleans, a real place, the projects that were torn down in 2003. I love the name, too, the Desire Projects. That was the original title for the novel.
Yeah.
In fact, when I was working on it, the working title was The Desire Project.
Oh.
She was raised by a single mother in poverty and got herself a scholarship to Tulane University, a very prestigious university in New Orleans, and did really well and then got to the newspaper, got this break. But she's also sort of passing. You know, she's passing for middle class. She's with her friends and with her associates at the newspaper, her colleagues. She's trying to seem like someone who had all the same advantages they did, and so she keeps her past a secret to a very large degree. So she's got, you know, she's got a secret history. And engaging with this kind of criminal situation, meeting criminals, going into the homes of criminals, to interview them, which is very dangerous, really kicks up some of her own issues and background and so on. And so she's struggling as the city is struggling. And in terms of how I introduced her to the readers, you know, she's a bit mouthy, a bit edgy, a bit reckless. She's 27, and she's figuring things out still in her career and in her personal life. So she's taking some risks. She's bold. She's making some mistakes. And she gets into some trouble. But she's good-hearted, and I think people will resonate with that.
Now, the one thing, like we mentioned before, that this is your debut book, but this is not actually your debut book, because when a lot of people go to your site, they're going to notice that, you know, you've written many different things. You know, you have many things in, you know, in journals, collections. You have a couple other books that are on here, you know, one that's like a nonfiction. But this is technically your first debut thriller novel that you've kind of gone through, you know, the process of, you know, how like all those publishing houses and everything kind of work. How kind of was that process for you to kind of see how everything's going and maybe how the publishing has probably changed from when you first, you know, got accepted to now all of a sudden now? How has that been for you?
Well, it's an intriguing process, certainly. And you're right. I mean, I've been publishing like short stories and short essays for about 20 years now since I was in graduate school. And there's a real difference between literary publishing in little journals and then publishing a book with a major trade publisher. It's just a very different experience. And exciting, of course. I mean, I had always
right.
wanted to write a mystery. I always loved and read mysteries from childhood, and so I was eager to try this. And in terms of how it's different, I guess... You know, I think I worked more intensively with both my agent and then my editor on the manuscript than I had worked before with an editor. My first book came out with a very good but small house in New York, and the editor really liked it very much the way it came in to her, and so we did a little bit of fine-tuning. But in terms of plot, that's where I really had to do a lot of work, because I was used to fiction that wasn't strongly plot-driven or suspense-driven. I was actually, if I can digress for a second, I was trained as a scholar of modernist literature. That's what my PhD is in. And so that's like Virginia Woolf and William Faulkner and James Joyce, P.S. Eliot. Not a lot of forward-driving suspense action in those books, even though I really love those writers and have been really influenced by them. There's not a lot of action. There's not a lot of cause and effect. What there are a lot of epiphanies, a lot of lyrical language, long, winding sentences, psychological texture, and so on. So I really loved those things. And my first draft of Hell or High Water was a lot heavier on the lyrical language and, you know, characters sitting around and having sudden epiphanies. And it was light on suspense and cause and effect and plot. So I really did get a lot of help from my very kind and patient agent and my very kind and patient editor to help me make it the kind of book I knew I wanted to write, but really didn't have the training and the background to write at first.
And again, we're speaking here with author Joy Castro, and the book is called Hell or High Water, a thriller set in post-Katrina New Orleans. Her website is joycastro.com. And see, it's the journey like that, because we have a lot of authors, of course, that listen to our show, read our magazine for different things, and it's everybody's experience is kind of a little different on kind of their journey on how they went through. And the other thing that you've been kind of doing is you've been doing a lot of blog tours. And for a lot of authors, that's sometimes difficult just because they're not used to really having to sell themselves to the public and talk about themselves like you are here now on the radio. And was that something that was difficult for you to have to overcome, to kind of put yourself out there in the public and to take either the criticism or the praise, you know, both sides, you know, going back and forth? You know, how did you kind of handle that, you know, kind of coming out?
That's a great question. I think a lot of writers wrestle with that because a lot of us are shy and introverted and we'd like to be, you know, in our library carrels with our books. So I think it's an issue for many of us, and certainly it has been for me as well. I think it gets easier with time, and as you share yourself with people, with readers, and the connection is so positive and so exciting, it becomes easier, it becomes less scary. In fact, I just wrote a little piece about that to give advice to writers who are shy or modest and don't want to talk about their work, and how they can do that in a comfortable way that is really, you know, authentic and connects with the people that are listening. And I always like learning from readers, you know, people who've written in about my memoir, for example, or people who come to readings and then want to talk afterwards about their own experience or their own stories. I always find that a real gift. And I think if you can concentrate on your audience and what they might be interested in or what they need or what they want to share, then it becomes more of a more natural relationship and less about selling yourself or putting yourself out there. Really, you're just, you know, connecting with other people who have stories, too, that are as interesting or more interesting than your own. So I really have come to like that part, although it was nerve-wracking at first, for sure.
Oh, I'm sure it was. I mean, because like I said, you know, authors, you know, they like to be in their pajamas. They like to sit behind their computer. They like to stay behind the camera. They don't like to get out in front of the camera. So it's
exactly
difficult.
Yes. That's absolutely.
And I think that's one thing that a lot of new authors, when they kind of come onto the scene, they're kind of like, oh, Simon and Schuster, Random House, you know, HarperCollins, wow, I'm signed. Now I've made it. and they don't realize that that's just technically you're now at the starting gate. That's just your starting point. Now the writing the book was the easy part. This is the hard part. The marketing of it is the hard part. The writing of it, that's easy. You guys know how to do that, you know, hands down, you know, to make characters. Now the rest of it, that's the hard part.
That's interesting. Yeah, I think that can be sort of overwhelming or a shock when writers find that out. So. But
yeah.
I think you can just focus on the fun part, all the people that you're going to meet that you would not get to meet otherwise, and how interesting they are. And it's an incredible gift to have total strangers be interested in your work. That's amazing. So if you can just, you know, for writers, if you can just focus on the gratitude part of it, then it all becomes a lot easier, I think.
And I see that you're going to be at VoucherCon here, which is going to be in Cleveland, October 4th through the 7th, and you're on a panel. Now, is this kind of the first time that you've kind of been to conferences talking about Hell or High Water? Were you at Thriller Fest? So is that kind of experience all new to you also?
VoucherCon will be my first such conference, and it'll be the first VoucherCon that I've attended, so I'm really excited. I've gone to other literary conferences like AWP, a national literary conference, but not one that's devoted to mysteries and suspense and thrillers. So this is going to be a thrill for me. I'll be there as a fan as much as I'll be there as a writer.
Yeah, you're going to just, you know, you'll be walking around and you'll be seeing a lot of your, you know, people that you read just kind of sitting there drinking. I'll tell you, the best place if you want to go meet them, just go to the bar. Because the other thing about authors, they like to get behind the computer, but once they leave, they like to drink. So
yes.
Go to the bar, and you'll just kind of sit there, and you'll start, you know, talking with all of them because they'll always be kind of hanging out there.
That's a great advice. Well, I'll probably see them there. See you there. Yeah.
Now, you know, here's a question that we kind of ask also is, because like yourself, and again, author Joy Castro, the book is Hell or High Water, joycastro.com. Book is available wherever you find books, all over the place. What scares Joy Castro?
Oh, wow. What a great question. Climate change scares Joy Castro. Yeah,
okay.
You laugh. I'm not joking. We're, you know, I live in the Midwest, and we're in the middle of a heat wave and a drought.
Yeah.
And, of course, the horrific impact that Katrina had in New Orleans was very much influenced by the fact that, you know, about 1,900 square miles of coastal wetlands had been lost from Louisiana's shores since the 30s. And so there's less land between communities and hurricane threats and now rising sea levels. So these are, you know, these are real issues that we're all going to be facing together, and how we face them, I think, is an interesting and complex problem. Probably too complicated for a mystery novel or a thriller to handle, because it's so diffuse, it's so big a problem, and so varied. But it's an interesting problem, and it really does scare me. I hope that we can respond to it swiftly and effectively. But crime, of course, scares me as well, street crime, the violence that can happen to anyone. And as you were saying when you opened the show, you know, we're all very sad today about Aurora and the people who were just going to the movies.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, that's horrific, and, you know, it's something that endangers us all. And, of course, the novel, Hell or High Water, focuses specifically on the violation of sex crimes. It's a murder mystery, but sex crimes are sort of the angle or the slant, and those crimes affect people for a long time. Some of the research that I did was about the long-term aftermath for survivors of sexual assault, and, you know, it doesn't just go away when the assault ends. Sometimes survivors struggle with depression or substance abuse or suicidal ideation for years after an assault occurs. So that has a long-term aftermath at the personal level, and then for us as a society. You know, there are a lot of people walking around who've experienced that damage.
Very well said. Now, we have a couple minutes left here. A lot of people would like to know probably what are they going to see from you in the future. I mean, I know that you just wrote Hell or High Water, but, you know, your fans are very fickle, and they'll go out and they'll read the book in a day, and then they'll be like, okay, Joy, where's the next one? Can you send it to me? So what can we expect in the future from you?
Well, Nola comes back next year. She will...
So you're going to be writing a series with Nola. So she's going to be a series character.
There's definitely a sequel. And it'll be called Nearer Home, and it'll come out next summer. So another scary beach read. After that, I'm not sure, but I certainly have some plot ideas and some things that might happen to Nola. So I'm kind of tinkering with those ideas now. The next one is also set in New Orleans, and it's already at the publishers. A former professor of Nola's is murdered, and so she gets involved in finding out about that crime.
So that's very interesting. So that's going to be coming up, like you said, next summer, so fans of Nola can definitely expect to see more from you. Again, the book is Hell or High Water. We've been speaking here with author Joy Castro. JoyCastro.com is her website to find out all the exciting information. You have a lot of great information up there with your links and your blog and everything else you have going on. And Joy, we just want to thank you so much for coming on. It's been fabulous.
Thank you very much.
We'd like to see what's coming on in the future. We'd love to have you back on when your next book comes out. So again, thank you so much, and you know, much success with the book.
Thank you. Okay, thanks, John.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So again, everybody, author Joy Castro, the book is Hell or High Water. You can get this wherever books are sold. This is definitely an intriguing read, set thriller, post-Katrina, New Orleans. Great subject matter, excellent characters to definitely go out and get the book. We highly recommend that. We are going to be coming up here with our next guest, John Verdon, who's going to be on. We're going to be back in about a couple minutes with John. So until then, we're going to leave you with something to listen to.
Cheers.
welcome everybody back from the break. Again, I want to thank Joy Castro, joycastro.com. The book is Hell or High Water. It was just on. Fabulous lady and tremendous interview. We are going to go right now into our next guest, author John Burden, with the book Let the Devil Sleep. And John, can you hear me? I think you might have me on speakerphone. Oh, John, are you there? How you doing, John?
That sounds better. I'm doing fine
now
today.
I gotcha. I'm hitting the wrong buttons over here. I tell you, my electronic stuff is just messed up right now. But there we go. We got the right setup now. So John Burden, author of the book Let the Devil Sleep. John, thank you so much for coming on. How are you?
My pleasure, and I'm glad to be here.
Right now, like we've talked about, the book comes out July 24th, so everybody can still pre-order it, but the book comes out on Tuesday. And your book, you know, I mean, it takes place in today. It's, you know, you got a homicide detective in New York. Tell everybody a little bit about the book and your character, Dave Gurney, and, you know, the setup and behind-the-scenes action.
Okay, sure. Dave Gurney, the character in the book is a retired NYPD homicide detective, and he and his wife have moved out to a very rural part of Upper New York State, out in the mountains, and they've kind of had different ideas about what this retirement is going to be like. I think his wife imagined that Dave was going to turn into a different kind of person, maybe a sort of a nature lover or something, but the fact is that Dave is kind of born and bred a detective. It's the way he thinks. It's been his life for 25 years, and he's having a heck of a time staying retired. And he ends up getting involved, getting pulled into a couple of cases. And just to bring you up to date on where we are at the beginning of this third book, Let the Devil Sleep, which is it's the third in the series. He's suffered some injuries at the end of the second book, and at the beginning of Let the Devil Sleep, he's kind of depressed, he's kind of hanging around, and when an opportunity comes up for him to help a journalist who's putting together a program about a series of murders that happened about 10 years earlier, his wife kind of nudges him into it because she wants him to, you know, get out of the house and do something because he's starting to feel kind of depressed. Well, he gets involved in this investigation, looking at these murders that took place about 10 years earlier. And the way those murders were understood at the time, they were understood as the product of a serial killer who was out to get rich people. That series of murders involved roadside shootings of people in very expensive automobiles. And there was a whole understanding in the criminology field about what it was all about, and a whole FBI psychological profile of who this killer must be and so forth. And everybody thought they understood the case perfectly. There was just one little problem, and the problem was that the killer had never been caught. And as Dave Gurney starts to get into this and starts to probe it, really to help this young journalist understand what happened, he starts to realize that the basic understanding of the case and the FBI theory of the case is all wrong. So this creates a whole lot of conflict for Dave. He ends up directly opposed to the FBI. He ends up directly opposed to the other police agencies that investigated it. He ends up directly opposed to the whole criminology establishment that's where psychologists have written books about the case. He ends up very much isolated and alone, but still proceeding with this investigation. I think the idea for this, John, came from a notion I had a long time ago that I really would like to write a book about a crime that had been completely misunderstood, a crime that everybody thought was fairly simple and straightforward. And then when you get into it, you discover that, well, wait a minute, that's not really what it was about. There was a whole other crime underneath the crime. And this works well with this Dave Gurney character of mine, because he's the kind of guy who tends to look at things in his own particular way. And he's a prober, he's in a way a kind of a Sherlock Holmes guy, where he's constantly looking for, I don't know, we call it the revealing clue or the revealing moment, and following his own trail through something, which very often ends up in conflict with the way other people see it. I think, you know, that's the general place I'm coming from with the book.
Now, and like you said, this is the third book, so Dave has, you know, kind of moved himself forward, and now he's been put in kind of this position. But the intriguing part, like you said, is always when you kind of have, I guess, a cold case, if you want to call it, and now kind of coming back and surfacing itself back together, you almost have to go back, you know, as your character has to go back and look at those kinds of things. You're using, you know, a lot of the basic detective kind of skills that you have to have, that a lot of, you know, things when you're going forward, it's almost like you don't have to have anymore, because there's so much technology and there's so many things that, you know, you can use, where you can almost like not even let your brain really have to work that much, because the machines or the computers and the technology and the science kind of tell you everything. Was that kind of, you know, how Dave has to kind of approach these situations? Is that kind of how his mind has to think? And even though he's kind of been, you know, retired, he still has that edge and that feeling that he still, you know, he has to be the detective, because he's more of the old school, like I said, without the technology, and he actually has to use his head?
Yeah, I think so, John. I think that this is not a CSI kind of series. It's not a series based on, you know, the discoveries through electron microscopes and that kind of thing. It's in a sense, this is a series about the detective as a person, and it's much more reliant on his own drive, his own intelligence, his own curiosity. As opposed to all of the technology that very often surrounds an investigation. I think maybe I approach the detective genre in a more general way. I mean, I see the thriller mystery as a wonderful structure for examining a lot of issues and examining a lot of the ways just simply that people relate to each other. And I think one of the things that's emerged from a lot of the reviews that I've seen of the first two books, one of the things that's a little different about the Dave Gurney series is that it's a bit more character driven than some detective books. You know, it has a lot more to do with the people in the books and, you know, how those people conflict with each other. That really drives the plots of these things, and it's much more about the people than about the technology.
Is that kind of the emails that you get from your fans, that, you know, that's what they enjoy so much, is the fact that it's a lot more character-driven, while there's the story, and you always have to be the intriguing story, but just the interaction between the characters, whether it's the hero or the villain or and the secondaries and everybody that you kind of have to bring in, you're going to have to kind of create this world. Is that what you get from your fans a lot?
I think that I get two things. There seem to be two aspects of the book that people really like, and I think it's the interaction of the two that really makes them perhaps unique. There are always puzzles in these books. There's always something about the crime that it's been committed in a way that doesn't seem possible. In a way that kind of harkens back to the old golden age of detective fiction stuff, you know, back in the 30s and 40s, where a lot of these things had to do with impossible crimes. I mean, how could that be? You know, how did the body end up there? There's no way that could happen. There's that aspect of it. But then, as I think it was the Washington Post maybe pointed out about the second book, or the, I think they said that, you know, it's this interesting combination of sort of an Agatha Christie approach plus somehow this Raymond Chandler approach, where, you know, where you it's a little darker than the old Golden Age stuff, and the darkness I think comes out of some of the people as well. One of the things, by the way, that keeps coming up again and again in what I hear from readers is a fascination with the rather complicated relationship between Gabe Gurney and his wife. Unlike a lot of detective fiction, Dave Gurney's wife is a very powerful character in these books, and there aren't a lot of detective books, at least not that I've read, where the wife is a very significant three-dimensional character, you know, as opposed to just, you know, the woman in the shadows.
Right.
And I think a lot of people like that. They like the complexity of the marriage.
Now, when you started writing the series, was that something that you were conscious that you were going to do? Or did it just kind of end up being that way because you wanted to kind of have that dynamic? And like you said, you wanted to kind of be a little different with your characters. I want to remind everybody, too, that we're speaking with author John Verdon. The book is Let the Devil Sleep, and John's website is johnverdon.net to find out a lot more information. But was that something that you were thinking about doing when you started writing the series, when you were going to put these things together? Or like I said, was it just something that just kind of came about as you were continuing on?
I think that just about everything with these books just, in a sense, came about. Because when I wrote the first book, I mean, it how that came about was a strange thing. I mean, I was in the advertising business most of my life. And retired some years ago up to the mountains outside New York City. And I was building furniture and doing whatever, you know, occurred to me that might be fun. And one day my wife said to me, you know, John, she said, you've been writing that advertising stuff, you know, for years and years and years. And every once in a while, you know, you used to have that little gleam in your eye that you might want to write, you know, a novel or a piece of fiction or something. She said, you know, maybe it's time to try that. And I did. I mean, I liked reading detective novels. There were, you know, I mean, I love Raymond Chandler, love Ross MacDonald, love some of the British writers. And I, after reading about 100 of those things, it occurred to me that I understood what they were doing. I understood the structure of the genre. I knew what it was about. And so when my wife encouraged me to take a shot at it, I agreed, and I did. And what resulted from that was the first book, Think of a Number, and that was published by Random House in 2010. And then they encouraged me to see, you know, do you think these characters have legs? You know, are these characters interesting and complex enough to, you know, take them on to a, you know, another book or two or three? And I started thinking about it, and I realized, yeah, well, yes, they are. And I think that the reason that the characters in my books are kind of interesting and three-dimensional is that when I write these things, I mean, that's how I'm spending my life. You know, I mean, once I'm writing one of these novels, my novels tend to be a little longer than many of these, detective mystery thrillers. You know, they run between 400 or 500 pages. So when I'm writing one of these things, I mean, I'm in that world every day. I walk into the den in the morning, and I sit down, and I'm in that world. And this may sound kind of self-indulgent, but the fact is, I don't want to spend my time with characters I don't like. So
right.
So I mean, I think they have a level of complexity and a level of interaction with each other that, I don't know, it just reflects the way I want to spend my time, and it reflects the kind of people I'm interested in myself. So I think that's where it came from, and I guess you could say that's accidental.
Well, it's very true, because an author, when they write, and your world and your coworkers are your characters. And some people don't like going to work because they don't like their coworkers. So why would you want to sit behind your computer and write characters, which are basically your coworkers working with you, that you don't like? Because the fans will then know, and they'll feel that. They'll see the emotion, and they'll see what you're trying, you know, how you're doing. And then it'll just kind of be a, kind of a, like a letdown. It's like, oh, he's not really into this, or he's not really, you know, writing with the emotion, you know, that an author should write. Even if, you know, when you're writing thrillers or any, you know, kind of anything. Heck, I just finished Murder on the Orient Express for, I don't know, the fifth time. With Agatha Christie, I just read it. And I just downloaded, I just got the movie, the DVD, and I'm sitting there, I was watching that, and I just, you know, realizing, wow, you know, Sean Connery and all these people were in this movie. But,
right.
Yeah, it's, you kind of get drawn back to those kinds of things.
Yeah, and I like that way of putting it, too. It is like going to work every day. And when I did go to work every day in the city in the advertising business, a heck of a lot of the way I felt about it was determined by who I was going to be in the office with that day.
Right.
And that's the way it is with my books. And I guess I feel very fortunate right now that these books have kind of come out of my own interests, the things I want to write about, the issues I want to write about, the kind of relationship problems I want to write about, the kind of puzzles that fascinate me. I mean, in that sense, it's all very self-indulgent. I mean, these books interest me. I like them, you know. I like
right.
creating them. And then I have this kind of, you know, bonus where they've turned out to be very popular. And, I mean, in fact, popular beyond anything anybody expected. And, I mean, these books have been on bestseller lists in around the world. They're enormously popular in Spain, for example. They've been on bestseller lists in Bulgaria, in Turkey, in Israel. They've been translated into Russian, Chinese, I mean, Vietnamese.
Wow.
So, you know, all of that has been kind of strange, wonderful bonus. I mean, I feel like a very lucky guy. I get to sit down and write about stuff that interests and amuses me. And by God, there's people in Vietnam reading this. I mean, good Lord.
Yeah. Yeah, languages you don't speak, but your book's written into, it's kind of always a little bit surreal.
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't know. And you know, the other strange thing is that it's come to me at a strange time in my life. I mean, I'm a retired guy, and I, you know, where did all this come from? It came from my wife saying, you know, why don't you write a book?
You know what? They always say behind every good man is a good woman.
Well,
and so there you go. I guess the adage is true in your case, too.
Well, I think it's also true in the case of the character.
Yeah.
Dave Gurney, had, you know, his wife, Madeline, is a kind of beacon of light for my detective. Dave Gurney is this very kind of introspective, super logical, rational guy who spends a hell of a lot of time in his own head. And he's always trying to figure something out. He's always trying to get to the truth of something and analyzing patterns and looking. You know, and his wife is very different. She's very present in the world. She enjoys the moment. She's always trying to get him to, you know, come out and, you know, see what a beautiful day it is. So
mm-hmm.
you have this kind of little conflict thing going, but it's a very nice conflict. And I guess all I'm saying is that, yeah, Madeline is a good woman behind Dave Gurney, too.
And again, we're speaking here with author John Verdon. The book is Let the Devil Sleep. JohnVerdon.net is his website. So what else, you know, besides the book that you kind of have going on in, you know, in your life? Like, what's on your DVR? You know, what's kind of like the man behind the book? You know, your hobbies that you kind of get out when you're done and you're done writing for the day and you're going to go out and, you know, maybe wander around and do something, you know, that you do besides writing.
Well, you know, that's an interesting thing. I think my own tendency is to get totally involved in the writing. And in a way, I rely on my wife to make sure that I don't forget that there's, you know, our other things in our life together other than me writing. So, you know, she'll get me, we happen to live very close to the Delaware River, so, you know, we'll get out there in our kayaks. I think I mentioned to you when I first retired from advertising, I started building furniture, and I, you
yep.
know, so that's a kind of an ongoing pleasure. And I built all the furniture for our house, and I built a lot of furniture for my kids' homes and so forth. I don't know. Maybe it all has to do with constructing things. You know, it's like, I mean, I almost see the plots of the novel as you know, construction challenges. You know, there's something about a mystery novel that has to do with construction. I mean, any plot, of course, has to be constructed. But in a mystery novel, you can't just start writing. You got to know where it's going. And sometimes I see it as, you know, the hidden city. And the detective comes along and he sees, you know, this little bit of something sticking out of the ground, and it catches his eye, and he starts digging, and he starts trying to figure out just exactly what it is he's uncovering. But as a writer, you have to have constructed that hidden city already. I mean, you have to know what it is the detective is chasing after. And, I mean, it seems to me there's something analogous in that to the problems I encounter if I'm building a cabinet, or if I'm building a bureau, or you know, I'm building a fancy dining room table or something. It's somehow somehow
right.
The challenge is similar.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, it's about construction, and you're constructing. You know, whether it is furniture, whether it is a book, or no matter what it is, there's always some kind of construction that you're creating.
Yes, and there's a pleasure in seeing it when it looks right, and I have the same feeling if I put together a cabinet with shelving and three drawers and whatever, I know when the proportions are right. And they're probably following some rules. I mean, I don't happen to know the rules, but when I put together a piece of furniture and I start, adjusting here and there, I know when the proportions are right. And I have the same feeling about a plot in the book. I mean, I know when it's working. I know when the proportions are right, I mean, I feel so fortunate because it's all a pleasure.
Now, do you go on, any tours? Are you going to go out? Are you doing any other blog tours, or do you voucher cons or things like that, conferences, signing, where people, have a chance to kind of maybe go out and meet you or see what else you're doing kind of out in the world of the super information highway, if you want to call it?
Well, I mean, I'll tell you, all of that is kind of developing. As for the blog tour, sure, I've done the, I guess it's TLC, is that the name of it?
The TLC, okay.
Yeah, that blog tour I'm going to be on starting next Tuesday, and I think there's probably about 20 different bloggers who, will review the book and talk about it and so forth. So there's that. In terms of physical presence, I've been to Spain a couple of times because the books are so enormously popular there, and we've made a couple of trips to Barcelona for book fairs and for book signings and for press interviews, and similarly we've been to Amsterdam for the same kind of thing. The books are actually at least as popular in Europe as they are here, and in some countries more so. So most of the physical touring has been in Europe. In terms of the, if you call it, the internet or the, that whole connected world over here, we're getting much more into that this year, and we've set up a Facebook page, we have in fact just started up our website a couple of months ago. I've been, to tell you the truth, I mean, I feel sort of bad about this. I've been kind of, maybe because it's, because I'm not a young guy, I've been sort of resistant to a lot of this social media stuff. But
right.
I think I've been slowly been brought around by a lot of people at Random House and my agent and so forth, basically people who are younger than I am, and have finally convinced me that this stuff makes sense. So we're doing a lot more of that right now.
And real quick, because we got maybe like about a minute left, you have some very exciting news about the book already with some early stuff with Publishers Weekly. Tell us about that real fast.
Oh, sure. Yeah, we just got this great news that Publishers Weekly selected Let the Devil Sleep as one of the five best books to be published next week. I mean, and that includes fiction, nonfiction, all kinds of books. Of all the books to be published next week, Publishers Weekly has put out a list of what they consider the five best books. And Let the Devil Sleep made the list, so we're absolutely delighted. And I guess the other piece of it is that the fact that Don Imus has apparently selected the book for the Imus Book Club, which I think he's going to announce next Tuesday on its publication date. So it's off to a good start, and part of that good start is your interest in it, which I'm awfully grateful for.
Well, John, we want to thank you so much for coming on. Again, everybody, author John Verdon, the book is Let the Devil Sleep. JohnVerdon.net is the website. Wish you much success. We want to thank you so much for coming on. The book is wonderful. Recommend all of our listeners and fans to go out and check out, like you said, book three of Dave Gurney, and go check out Let the Devil Sleep. So thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right. You have a good day, John.
Thank you. You too.
So again, everybody, author John Verdon, the book Let the Devil Sleep, and johnverdon.net is the website. We are going to be right back here in a couple minutes with our next guest, another John, John Everson. So you're going to have three Johns today on the show, and he will be coming up in just a second. So in the meantime, here you go. Welcome you back, everybody, at the halfway point here of Suspense Radio, our two-hour show that we have going on. Again, I said at the beginning of the show, and I just want to say it one more time to all of, we live in a world of fiction, we read fiction, we write fiction, we talk about fiction, and there's a lot of things, suspense, mystery, thriller, horror that we go over, but there is a real life out there that is much more dangerous and much more scary, and that was no more prevalent than the shooting that just happened in the state of Colorado, Aurora, Colorado, in the movie theater. And our hearts go out from the Suspense Radio and Suspense Magazine team to all of the victims and the families and the friends and everybody affected by that sickening tragedy. We have a lot of author friends that live around the area, and we hope everyone is okay also. So we'd like to hear from you. If you want to email us and let us know, that would be fabulous. Again, we just wanted to say that. We are going to go here now with our next guest and his author, John Everson. The book is called Nightwear, and you can find it out in the Kindle edition out on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, places like that. So, John, we want to thank you so much for coming on, and how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
So, again, so the book is Nightwear, and you're an author that, like we just talked a little off the air, we don't get a lot of, but it's always fascinating because your content is a little more dark. It's a little more horror-driven, kind of something that, like I said before, is a little bit more, it's just not maybe as quite out there like it should be, because horror is definitely one of those most fascinating topics because it kind of hits people in a much different way than it is the thriller of, you know, seeing somebody being chased, you know, down the street with the gun or with the, you know, with the car chases and things like that. Horror is definitely my favorite genre, I have to say, because of how the emotions it touches. So tell everybody a little bit about Nightwear and, you know, the book and behind the scenes and things like that in your writing.
Sure, sure. Nightwear is my sixth novel overall. It just came out in ebook, as you mentioned, from Sam Hain, who has sort of picked up the horror mantle over the last year. People who read a lot of horror know that Leisure Books, for the last decade or two, really developed a huge line of horror and had, you know, most of the major authors in the genre working there. And, you know, with the whole ebook revolution and the slowly dying mass market paperback, they hit the bricks and pretty much died last year. So now there's a whole new line over at Sam Hain, and I'm happy to be on it. My first book for them is Nightwear. And Nightwear is basically a story of a couple who they have a bit of an interesting marriage. They're an open relationship couple. She, her name is Ray, is very into being with other men. She has a little bit of a pain fetish going on. And her husband pretty much tries to support her. He goes along with it. But then things take a turn for the dark because, you know, it's one thing to sort of be in an open marriage and have a little fun on the side, but then they get an invitation to this very, very exclusive secret club called Nightwear. And Ray is especially drawn to this because Nightwear will allow you to do anything, and I mean anything you want, with an erotic overtone. So she dives in, Mark goes along with her, and, you know, at first he's a little apprehensive, and then he's downright, you know, we need to not do this. We need to not be here. But,
right.
You know, as with anybody who gets roped into an obsession, she's not easily dissuaded. And so the bulk of the novel really is sort of their disintegrating marriage and him losing her, essentially. She leaves home and doesn't come back for Nightwear. And he has to try and get back into the club to find her. And that may sound, you know, not too hard, except that the thing about Nightwear is it only appears once a month in a secret location, and that location changes every month, so you have to have an invitation. So in a sense, it's a little bit of a thriller mystery because he's kind of looking for clues and trying to find out how to get back to his wife. But it's also a very, very dark novel in that the inhabitants of Nightwear are perhaps a little more or a little less than human.
Hey, you know, you got sex and violence, everything going on here. Ain't nothing wrong with that. Now, and what I find, you know, like I said, what I find intriguing, like, about horror is one of the main things that you just said, which was that Nightwear changes and is only like a once a month thing. So not only is it kind of a secret invitation kind of organization, if you want to call it, a club, but that's also along the lines of where you bring in the mystery aspect into the horror is, what is it? What's behind the scenes? Maybe who's running it? And those whole kinds of things. And do those questions kind of get answered within the book, Nightwear?
Absolutely. To not necessarily to Mark and Ray's benefit, but they do. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, that's the fun part of writing a horror novel, is to dig into something really dark and slowly peel back the layers and find out, oh my God, it's even worse than I thought at the beginning. And then, of course, to see how your characters actually are able to conquer or grow or perhaps not survive from it, but hopefully come out on the other end.
When you were kind of growing up and you were deciding, you know, hey, because horror is definitely a topic that you kind of have to, a lot of people love it or hate it. There's really not a lot of in-between. Was that kind of the books and kind of the things that you read yourself were the horror novels? You liked the Halloweens and the Friday the 13th and kind of those types of movies?
Honestly, no. And, you know, it's funny you mentioned the love-hate thing. Horror sort of goes in cycles, I think. You know, you'll have a decade where it rides really high, and then there's a huge backlash, and nobody wants to say they read horror. And, you know, right now we're sort of in that realm where most of the people who write or read horror would now say, well, yeah, I read dark thrillers, or I write paranormal romance, or they've moved on to sort of another label for the same kind of fiction, honestly. I mean, we all love to read fiction that does have sort of some dark scares to it. It's just a question of whether you want to say, yes, it's horror. But no, when I grew up, I was a total science fiction reader. So most of the stuff I read was classic sci-fi, Isaac Asimov, Clifford Simak, or C-Mac, however you say his name, Hal Clement, Paul Anderson, Heinlein, all of those guys. That was what I really grew up reading. But I also read a lot of, like, Richard Matheson, who was brilliant in pairing up sci-fi kinds of themes with a dark twist. And it was always the dark twists at the end of stories that I really, really loved. And so when I started writing fiction, that's kind of the stuff that seemed to come out. And I got to blame some of it, too, probably on watching an awful lot of Outer Limits and Twilight Zones when I was a kid. While I may have been writing or reading science fiction, I did see an awful lot of horror or creepy TV, Alfred Hitchcock Presents, that kind of stuff. So that all fed the love for the dark side, I think.
And again, we're speaking here with author John Everson, and it's johneverson.com. The latest book he's written is Nightwear. That's night, and that's W-H-E-R-E. So a lot of people have to, you know, they can't spell like me, then you have to tell them. But you, like you said, this is your, you know, this is your eighth book. You've written many other kinds of things. You had The Pumpkin Man that came out in October 2011. A lot of other kinds of things, and you kind of wrote, you know, Christmas Tales. What the heck is Christmas Tales? Is that a horror book? I gotta understand, because I'm sitting here looking at Siren and you know, the 13th with the knife coming and Covenant and Failure and all these things, and then I see Christmas Tales. And I go, this has to be about, like, some evil freaking Santa.
No. Christmas Tales is as far away from horror as you can get. I've always been a huge, huge Christmas fan, and I love fantasy, too. I read a lot of lighter fantasy growing up. Nina Kariki Hoffman, in fact, is one of my favorite authors. She writes a lot of magic fantasy, and I grew up doing a lot of short stories in the 90s, and every now and then, you know, I wouldn't write a horror story. I'd write a light fantasy, and there were a couple of them that revolved around Christmas. And a couple of years ago, I thought, you know, now with the ebook revolution, if people want to see some of those nice stories instead of them being interspersed in nasty stuff, I should pull them out. So I did. I grabbed a couple of the previously published Christmas stories that I'd done. I wrote a new one based on a song I'd written. I used to, for the family, my sister-in-law and I used to record. I'd write a new Christmas song, and then she'd sing it, and we'd record that every year, and that was kind of a gift to the family. So one of those songs had a nice little plot to it, and so I took that and turned it into a full-fledged story. So Christmas Tales is three short stories about Christmas. They're all light fantasy, as well as some lyrics from all those songs I used to write. So that's out there for family and anyone to read. And then there's also a story called Petey Boo and the Worm, which is for, like, 5-6-year-olds. That I wrote for my son, and he really loved it, and his friends loved it because it got read at his class, so that's out there. So, yeah, not everything that's on Amazon for me is horror.
And that's kind of the great thing, that you're able to kind of transition back and forth and do many different things. And so for people that are kind of new and they're not really sure, they're like, oh, who's this John Everson guy and you know, what's his book? So besides Nightwear, which is your latest book that's out right now and it's on Amazon Kindle, people can get it, what book would you tell them, you know what, if you really want to kind of understand maybe who I am as an author, why don't you pick this one up first? Because you have, you know, quite a selection of books. You know, Needles and Sins, the cover alone might just tell people this is who you are, but I don't know. Which book would you kind of let them know that they should get after Nightwear to kind of get an idea of who you are as an author?
Well, it depends if you're going to push for short fiction or novels. If you're going to talk about short fiction, I probably would actually push Needles and Sins. That's, I think, my thickest short story collection, and I think probably collects the best stuff I've done. One of the stories in it was nominated for a Bram Stoker Award when that book came out, and several of the other ones were in honorable mention lists from the year's best fantasy and horror anthologies. So I think that book's really, really strong in terms of who I am as a short fiction writer. But in terms of the novels, I would probably suggest Siren. I think that book, in particular for me, was one of my most personal books because I wrote that shortly after my son was born. And prior to that, of course, I wasn't a parent and I didn't have any of those, you know, huge parental fears that you get once you have a child. And so that book's leap-off point is pretty much a guy who is an aquaphobe. Can't go in the ocean, yet he lives near the ocean. And he's walking back and forth on the beach every night, torturing himself, thinking about suicide, because a year before, his son drowned in the ocean, and he couldn't save him because of his fear. So that, you know, that's sort of the jumping-off point of the book, and that's a really hard, you know, parental kind of feeling that I really had first become acquainted with them. I have, luckily my son is great and he's finally learned to swim this year. I was starting to worry that he wouldn't. he was afraid of the water is sort of the reverse. In the book, it's the father is afraid. In any case, our lead ultimately stumbles upon a siren who's literally a naked woman standing out on the beach at night singing an entrancing, beautiful song. He just can't get enough of it. And then she dives in and disappears, and he pretty soon is seeking her out, coming back night after night looking for her. Of course, things evolve, and it becomes a very physical relationship. And she actually gets him into the water, which is kind of interesting. But in addition to his relationship with the siren Lygia, the book has a parallel story going on where it's talking about how she actually came to this section of the California beach 100 years before. And both of the stories sort of run, every other chapter until you get to the end of the book, and they really both have their climax in about the same place. So it was a really neat book structurally to write. It has a lot of personal emotion in it, and I think it's really one of my best stories.
What's the greatest compliment that a fan can give you as an author?
I couldn't put it down. I read it in one night.
And here's another thing. Do you secretly laugh when you get an email from somebody saying, John, thanks a lot for the book, but it scared the hell out of me and I don't like you anymore? Do you, like, laugh about that? You sit there and say, good, that's what I wanted to do.
Exactly. I don't laugh at all. That is what I wanted to do. If people are reading the book and they're like, okay. Well, that really doesn't accomplish my purpose. You know, I want to drag them in. I want to have them so involved in the story that they feel the fears and fright of the characters, because that's what makes it fun. That's what makes any sort of horror or suspense novel a fun ride, is to really be on the edge of your seat and pushing the pages faster and faster, trying to find out, oh my God, does he die? What's going to happen? So I hope I scare them. I hope they stay up awake at night after reading one of them.
And so speaking of that, since that's your kind of goal, what scares you? What scares John Everson?
Loss. And that's truly why I think I like Siren so much. I mean, Siren is about recovering from loss. And I think whether it's loss of your life, loss of your family, loss of your property, I think that's really the core fear that drives all of us to do virtually everything. Some people are a little more flip about life than others, but I think we all kind of want to hold on and preserve the things that we love. And so that's the biggest fear for me. You know, you mentioned the horrible thing in Denver at the start of this segment. That encapsulizes the most horrible thing. And, to be just going and doing something that you enjoy and to have your life just taken from you without any reason at all, that is the most frightening thing in the world.
Yeah, and that's just... And like we said, we live in this world of fiction, but there is, the very real world that we do have to live in every day. And when you see these horrible things, it's just like, it's just ridiculous. And there's no other better way. I don't know how to put it. It's just sickening. And that's just kind of the way that, we feel about it. But
no, and I think in some ways, a creepy horror story allows you to sort of
get away
through fears and get past those things. I could. There are a lot of people who will do the serial killer books and whatnot, and I can't sort of write that kind of horror because it's too close to every day. I mean, it's too close to what happened yesterday. I don't want to go there. I don't want to think about that. But
yeah, I mean, I perfectly understand. Those types of things, and those are kind of the real things. And what we like is, when we're able to read a book and feel the emotions of fear and scared, and it's kind of like riding a roller coaster, but you know what? It's over, and it's over with in, a matter of a day of, reading a book, or a matter of, a couple minutes on a roller coaster or something, to that effect. And then you're able to just kind of say, ooh, you get the little thrill ride, the little jolt, the adrenaline, and then you just kind of move on. But in the real life, these people, it's never going to go away, and it will never go away. And that's kind of the scary part about it. And that's why, we always love the world of fiction, because that's just exactly what it is.
Right. I mean, and I think you hit it on the head. It's sort of, there's a big difference between riding a roller coaster and riding a car crash, right?
Mm-hmm.
People slam a lot of horror writers, and probably have slammed me at some point for writing too visceral or too over the top or too violent sorts of scenes. But it's a roller coaster. It's not meant to be taken seriously. It's not meant to hurt anyone. The real life stuff, that's what's scary.
Yeah, without a doubt. And we're speaking here with author John Everson, and the latest book that he wrote was Nightwear. It's available right now on Amazon Kindle. JohnEverson.com is his website. So kind of give us a little bit about, some of the other things that are sort of in your brain. The one book that kind of intrigues me, of course, is your book Covenant, which was the winner of a Bram Stoker Award. Kind of give us a little bit about that one, because I have not read it. I'm not, I just kind of, stumbled upon it on here and looking around. But it looks very interesting, and I kind of like to know a little bit more about, what it is.
Sure. In Covenant, you asked before what I'd recommend people start with. That's kind of my close second choice to Siren, because it is my first novel. Covenant was initially driven by somebody who gave me a newspaper article. I was at the day job, and she says, I know you like that creepy stuff, so I saw this, thought you might be interested. And I read the article. It was about a cliff in England where people go up to the top of the cliff. There's a bar right near the edge. They have a drink, and it's really the site where the most suicides happen in that country. So sort of the have your drink and dive. I thought that was pretty creepy, like she said, but I didn't do anything with that right away. But the idea never went away of this image of a dark cliff at night and people sort of leaping off. And probably about a year later, I started the initial draft of what would become Covenant. It was called The Cliff initially. And it was a reporter who goes from Chicago. He's kind of had a bad relationship here, and he wants to start over. He goes off to this small coastal town. There's a lighthouse, or the remains of a lighthouse, I should say, out on the edge of town on this cliff, and somebody commits suicide there, and he wants to write a news story about it. Well, his boss doesn't want him to, and nobody in town wants to talk to him about it, and he thinks it's kind of weird since not much else happens in this tiny town but bake sales. So he, of course, keeps investigating, being a typical reporter. He won't let it go. And soon finds, there's probably a reason people haven't wanted to talk to him, because this is not a one-off or just, the most recent in a short series. people have been committing suicide off this cliff on the same day every year for 100 years. So it's not suicide. And it's probably not a serial killer either, because, you know, nobody's going to be around that long to have to have carried them out. So he spends, you know, pretty much half the book sort of trying to find out what really is holding this town in its grasp. Is it some sort of a coven? Is it a cult? Is it demonic? And he'll find out. Now, the good thing about Covenant is he does find out, and it's not a secret to say that at least our reporter survives, because he does go on to a sequel called Sacrifice, which is actually the complete opposite of Covenant. Covenant's kind of a claustrophobic small-town mystery. There's a lot of scenes that take place inside the cliff in a series of caves. Sacrifice takes him out of town and puts him on this road trip from hell, where they're, he and this young girl, who turns out to be able to talk to the dead and has been persecuted for that, they're kind of on the lam, and they start tracking down a serial killer who's going city to city and luring men back to hotel rooms, supposedly for sex, but they never get any, because her goal is an erotic sacrifice that at the end of a circuit will open this world to a race of succubi demons, and she'll kind of be their queen if she's successful. So Joe, my avid reporter, is off to try and stop this before the world's in ruin. So that was Sacrifice. And eventually I do hope to write a third in the series, but it hasn't happened yet. Maybe after the next book. We'll see.
Well, I'll tell you, that's a damn shame, no sex. I'm just going to let you know on that one.
I think maybe you should change
the ending of that one a little bit.
Some of the victims really were unhappy about that de nouveau.
Right. But that's the one thing about horror also, is most every horror, you know, book is a standalone, because you have to wrap everything kind of up in the thing. And what I find interesting is that you were able to kind of do a couple sequel, and there's not a lot that have been, you know, done correctly, just because it is difficult to write a horror sequel. You know, one of the ones most notably that I guess is one of the best in this movie is probably Alien. And you know, the original one with Sigourney Weaver. I mean, that's kind of the one. But it is a difficult thing to do with a horror genre, is to write sequels, because, you know, I mean, how much horror stuff can there be? I mean, of course, if you're writing a detective, there's always crime or somebody to that effect. But horror is a little bit different animal.
No, that's true. I mean, you know, once you run them through the monster, why would you want to just run them through the monster again? You know,
right.
You've already seen it in most plants. So I really did try and take that story in a very different direction when I came at it the second time.
So then, you know, we have about a minute or so left here. Tell everybody, and I have one quick question, so see if you can answer this one fast, and then I got another one. If you could have, you know, one author that you could kind of write a collaboration with, you know, who would it be? Who would you want to sit there and write a horror story with?
Well, I can. That's an easy one.
Besides Stephen King.
It would be Clive Barker. He probably was the author who influenced me the most when I was reading his short fiction and first starting to write short fiction. So that would be a dream. And the one thing I didn't want to forget to mention is I just completed doing a huge collaboration, which is just out this month. It's called V-Wars. Jonathan Mayberry, who's a phenomenal author, he's got a whole series of books out there.
Yes, he does.
Patient Zero and the like. And he pulled a bunch of us together to do a shared world anthology called V-Wars, which documents the vampire wars in the modern day. It's sort of, vampires are not some undead creature. They're actually a genetic mutation that had been stomped out, you know, 1,000 years ago and has now returned. And so we each deal with a different racial style vampire, because vampire cultural lore is really varied. It's not just the Bram Stoker type vampire. So we each chose a type of vampire and wrote a story around it, placed it in Jonathan's world. It was a really fun project, really great book, and I encourage everyone to check it out, V-Wars.
And with the you know, emergence of ebooks and everything else, your next book is probably could come out a little bit quicker than maybe the next year. So what can we expect from you in the future then?
Well, it won't be that quick, because I'm still writing it.
Okay.
It's called Violet Eyes.
That's all right. Take your time. Get it right.
Yep. I'm probably about a quarter of the way through it. It's a book about mutated spiders and flies. How about that? It's a bug book. It's a bug book. People who read my short fiction collection, Creeptick, which is all bug stories, there's three long bug stories in that book. The last story is actually the prologue to this book. And I knew that when I wrote it, it was going to be a while before I was able to write the novel, and I realized the prologue could be a standalone story, so I wrote it out a couple of years ago. But that's the book I'm working on now. It's a lot of fun. Haven't really dealt with, you know, creepy crawly kinds of monsters and my stuff that much, so I'm having a ball with this one.
Well, again, we want to thank you so much for coming on, John. Again, author John Everson, and the book is Nightware, along with many of the other things that you've been writing. JohnEverson.com is your website. So thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So again, everybody, we want to thank John Everson and John Verdon, who was on before, and Joy Castro. Again, before you can listen to all the archives. We're going to be here on our last break, and then we are going to be coming up with our last guest, Melissa de la Cruz, and she is going to be joining us. So we will see you here, in a couple minutes. We want to join you here for our last segment that we have here, Suspense Radio, two-hour episode we had today. Our next author coming up has written a sequel to her book, The Witches of Eastend novel, and the latest book is called Serpent's Kiss, came out June the 12th. Awesome, Melissa de la Cruz, we want to thank you so much for coming on today, Melissa, and how are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks so much for having me.
So, like I said, this is the next book in your Witches of Eastend novels section, if you want to call it the series, the second book.
Yes.
So, can you tell anybody a little bit about Serpent's Kiss, kind of maybe how the progression has come from Witches of East End, maybe where it's going, and kind of some behind the scenes for people who might not be familiar with the series.
Oh, sure. The Witches of East End centers upon a family of witches, a mother and two daughters. So there's Joanna, who's the mother, and her power is the ability to raise the dead, kind of bring the dead back to life. So she's a resurrectionist. And then Freya, who's the kind of the witch of love, her specialty is love potions, so she's a bartender. And Ingrid, who is a librarian, and she's kind of the witch of, like, kind of domestic spells, you know, kind of a goddess of the hearth and home. And she's a goddess of the home, and yet she's a single and has never been married in all her centuries. So the witches are not just witches, they're actually Norse goddesses who are trapped on Earth. So that's kind of the mythology behind the reason why they are supernatural. And in Serpent's Kiss, we're still dealing with kind of what happened to them kind of back in Asgard. There's this terrible tragedy that befell their family, and their brother is in limbo. He's kind of consigned to jail, and they don't know, you know, he has been kind of framed as somebody who destroyed, you know, it's called the Bofrir Bridge. It was the bridge that connected Asgard to Earth. You know, kind of like to Middle Earth, I guess, to our world. So he comes back, and Freddy comes back and basically says that he was framed and he wasn't the one who destroyed it, and he wants to figure out, and he knows who did it. And he tells Freya that the person who did it is her fiancé, Killian, who is the god Baldur. So so Freya has to decide whether her brother is telling the truth or her fiancé is telling the truth, and kind of figure out the mystery from there. And there's a lot of, like, different subplots where there's a ghost trying to come back to life and to warn the witches about something, and Joanna's kind of dealing with that. And then Ingrid has a bunch of magical pixies who are kind of lost. They're on their way from Alfheim and kind of got trapped in Middle Earth. And all the three stories kind of combine with the bigger mythology, and you know, you find out who the pixies are working for and, you know, what the ghost is trying to tell them. So it all kind of ties to the big story.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of, you know, just a lot of different little subgenres that, you know, you kind of have included, you know, in the book. That kind of makes for not only just the challenge in writing and then difficulty, but, I mean, it's just, it's a very much a woven web that you kind of have to kind of bring all together. How difficult is it for you, you know, having to do, taking on a challenge like that? Because it's not easy.
Yeah, it's not easy. And there are days when, you know, I was writing that book and I said, why did I decide to do this? This is so difficult. But, you know, I think I like when things, the story works on several different layers. Like, it's not just about witches and the Hamptons and the usual kind of small town domestic spells and kind of spats and, you know, kind of the usual, you know, witch story. I always like to layer it in with something maybe a little grander and a little bit more epic. And so that's kind of just where my imagination goes and where I kind of like to you know, write about, and it is hard, but you know, I've kind of been writing a lot of these big kind of interwoven long series epics for a while. So, you know, after a while you kind of get the rhythm of it going, and you kind of know, you know, how to kind of start your, you know, your top spinning and how to get them all together. So
that's, and is, like, that kind of, when you were growing up, is that like the authors and the kinds of stories, those kind of epic stories that intrigued you when you were reading?
Oh, definitely, definitely. I always feel like what I do now is what I wanted to do when I was 14 years old. And, you know, so much of everything that I do kind of goes back to being a young reader. The Norse mythology was something that always captured my imagination ever since I was, like, I think 8 years old, when they kind of, you learn about, you know, the Greek myths and the Greek gods and, you know, the Roman gods and the Egyptian gods. And I actually had to discover the Norse gods on my own in the library. And I still remember I found this book about, you know, the stories of Odin and Loki and Baldur. And I was just completely captivated by it because, first of all, I wasn't learning about it in school, where it was all about Athena and Apollo and all that, Zeus. And so for me, it felt like something personal that I discovered. And then also it was kind of like a smaller thing that not everybody knew about. Of course, now we're kind of living during the time when everybody's kind of learning about it, you know, especially with the movie Thor, and, you know, it's just kind of like all Norse gods all the time. But it wasn't like that, you know, kind of in the 80s. So it was, you know, I felt like it was my own little thing.
Yeah, I mean, just when, and a lot of people don't understand, yeah, I mean, a lot of that comes from, you know, the Norse god, of course, Thor, who's very popular, and then the book with the Avengers, and the movie came out, the Avengers, and then Chris Hemsworth making the character come to life.
Yes.
What it kind of does is it kind of gives a resurgence to those kinds of characters and those kinds of stories, which leads to where, you know, when people start reading you and they start reading the book Serpent's Kiss and the witches of East End, they're able to familiarize themselves with those things and the things that they now realize that they love.
Yeah, no, it's kind of nice. It kind of feels like, you know, a little bit like everybody is kind of becoming interested in the same things that I am now, so that's kind of cool. Witches of East End just got picked up for a pilot for Lifetime. So they're casting the pilot and making the TV show. So hopefully it'll be on TV next year. So we'll see.
So now is it going to be a movie, a miniseries?
It's for an hour drama, so a TV series. Hopefully.
A TV series.
Yes.
That's going to be very exciting. All of a sudden, did that just kind of come out of the blue, or was it in the works for a while?
It's been in the works for a while. We haven't been able to announce it because Lifetime, the network that bought it, they don't like to announce unless it's really happening. And the announcement just came in, I think, yesterday, actually. So the network just announced their pilots, so we were very excited. But we've known, you know, I've been sitting on the news for about a year, and finally we can share it with the world, so that's kind of fun.
Oh, man. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's got to be hard. You kind of sit on pins and needles. You want to kind of shout that out to everybody, and you can't really say anything. You're like, just one little thing, please.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's like, oh, it'd be kind of nice if we could tell people, you know, and make people excited about the book. But so now we can, so that's nice.
And now when you were, you know, thinking about writing, you know, the Witches of The Witches of East End.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know that you were going to be writing this as a series? Did you have a specific length in mind that you were going to do maybe a trilogy or four or five books? Did you have all that kind of concept wrapped up, or were you finished, or what? Or did it just kind of come to you later?
No, I always kind of know. I wanted Witches to be a little bit more open ended. Like, I wanted it to kind of follow like a little bit of like an Agatha Christie mystery series where, you know, every book there would be one mystery that was solved, but, you know, we'd have the kind of stable cast of characters. And then as I wrote the book, I just kind of naturally am inclined to do trilogies. So, as I wrote it, I was like, oh, it's kind of like a trilogy again. So I'm definitely doing a trilogy. As to more books after that, I'm not sure. I kind of had a more open-ended goal at first, but now as the story is shaped up and how I've told it, I kind of really like the idea of a trilogy. So for now, we'll say it's a trilogy.
Okay, so it wasn't really planned kind of that way. And I want to remind everybody that we're speaking here with author Melissa De La Cruz, and your website is melissa-delacruz.com, and the book right now that just came out is Serpent's Kiss.
Mm-hmm.
And I just know that when you kind of have all these characters and you're kind of writing about all these kinds of epic things, how many notes do you have to have beside you to make sure that you don't mess anything up? Because your fans will definitely come back and say, you can't do that because back in this thing, you said her favorite color was yellow, so you can't say her favorite color was purple now.
Oh, my God.
It's just little things like that. I mean, those are kind of like those little things. I mean, you just have to try to keep them all straight.
Oh, yeah. No, that's one of the hardest things about the series and series writing is you forget little things like that, and then you do get dinged on them. So what I do is I can't do it in the beginning because I feel like writers have to be free and just write whatever they want in the beginning. So I'll write just a story and, you know, not even read the first book when I write the sequel. And then after I do my first draft is when I kind of go back and say, oh, wait a minute, did I already say that it was, you know, something else here? So I kind of do the cleanup at the end. But from the beginning, I don't really do that. I don't, you know, kind of bother because I just feel like it kind of hampers you and you should let your imagination go wherever. And then later, you know, I always call it the story sink. It's like I sink the story at the end and see whether, you know, some plot hole or thing that I did contradicts something that I said in an earlier book. So then I fix it.
Now, and the one thing, like I said, when we talked a little bit off air, and this is something that kind of intrigued me when people go to your website, and I said I've never seen this before, is you have a link on there called School Projects.
Yes.
And And you basically have told people that if they're doing a school report on stuff, here's some information to be helpful. You've given them the cliff notes, so if anybody wants to kind of write the book or write a book report on it, you've kind of given it to them. I mean, an English teacher's got to be pissed at you.
Oh, no, it's not the cliff notes at all. You know, it's I am a young adult author, so a lot of my books are tailored. Witches of EastEnd is my first adult series, so but most of the bulk of my books are for teenagers. So I get a lot of emails from teenagers and from, you know, seventh graders, sixth graders asking, you know, for information. And actually most of the information in school reports are just about myself, because a lot of the questions they seem to, the teachers seem to want to know is where I was born, how old am I, what inspired me. You know, how do I write the book? So there's actually nothing about the books themselves. It's all kind of the background. And I actually modeled that part of my website on Rick Riordan's website. He has a section in his website called School Projects, and Rick used to be a teacher, so he kind of knows what questions they would ask. So I kind of did that to help the kids.
And do you get a lot of emails from, you know, from younger from younger kids, you know, younger adults that kind of email you and they kind of want to, you know what's going on, and maybe you, have you ever done like a book club with them and things like that to kind of sit them down? Because that gets them excited about wanting to write and especially wanting to read, which I think is something that's kind of lost maybe in today's youth a little bit. So it's great to, when you see an author like yourself, you know, inspiring young kids to get out there and write and read, you know, do you kind of do those things with them?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I do Skype classroom visits and, you know, every email gets answered by me or my assistant. I mean, usually they ask all the same questions, so we kind of have a little template of, you know, email responses. So it's always the same. You know, where did I get the idea? You know, what made me want to become a writer? So, yeah, you know, actually kids are reading a lot. The young adult market, the teen and kid market is the biggest in publishing right now. The kids are reading, so it's a wonderful thing.
Yeah, I just, you know, there's a lot of young adults books that are coming out, and right now, you know, we are covering a lot of that stuff within the magazine, because this is one of the fastest growing genres that are out there. And, you know, are you looking at, you know, do you like it when you're kind of expanding? If you're going to a class of people, and, of course, Serpent's Kiss is the book that has just come out, and your Witches of EastEnd novel, but for someone, you know, who might not know you, and younger kids, maybe, you know, 15, 16, 17, what would you recommend, you know, that maybe they go ahead after, you know, this thing, that they can read from you to kind of get the best idea of maybe who you are as an author, and to maybe give them the sense to kind of jump into your books? You know, because you've written so many. What would you recommend that they go ahead and they kind of start with?
Well, Blue Bloods, which is my vampire series, is kind of the most popular one. So that's kind of the one that made my name. And it's right now it's about 8 books in the series. There are about 6 novels that are published, and then there's like kind of a companion book with short stories, and then one with kind of more of an encyclopedia of the world. So I would recommend that, especially if they like vampire stories. So it's kind of a big family saga with, you know, a lot of romance and mystery. And, you know, it's kind of, each book is different, because I like to write different kinds of books, even in a long-running series. So one is like, might be more of a thriller, one might be more of a mystery, one might be more of a romance. But it's all about the fabulous vampires of New York. So that's what the story is.
And the one thing that I think if people look at, they're going to see if they click on your about, that, you know, you've written for, you know, many different magazines, and a lot of them, of course, are geared at, you know, young people and, you know, women by Cosmopolitan, Glamour, you know, Teen Vogue and Cosmo Girl 17, those things. Did that kind of help you kind of get into this world, because you are very engaging as an author, and, you know, a lot of authors like to stay behind the camera. They don't like to kind of get themselves out there because they have to kind of try to market themselves and kind of do those things. But you kind of seem very comfortable, you know, being able to talk about your stuff and being able to put yourself out there. Was it always that way, or was this something that you kind of had to learn, you know, as time went on, to kind of be that way? Because you are putting yourself, whether it's in the face of criticism or praise, you know, both, and sometimes authors feel uncomfortable with that.
Yeah, you know, I think my background as a journalist, you know, definitely toughens up your skin. Before I wrote for, you know, all the big mainstream magazines, I was actually an alternative journalist reporter. So I wrote for a very small kind of cult newspaper called the New York Press in Manhattan. And it was kind of incendiary, and we liked to kind of stir things up. And, you know, during the heyday, it was the paper that a lot of people read. You know, people would be talking about it. And I would write a lot of controversial articles about it because we kind of liked kind of, you know, kind of poking people. So, you know, that's what I did when I was in my early – that was kind of my introduction to publishing. So I've got – you know, I started out with a lot of hate mail. And once you start out with hate mail,
wow,
nothing can really – you know, nothing really gets to you anymore. And you learn to develop a tough skin. You learn to accept criticism. You learn it's better for people to talk about you than not talk about you. And I think from there I kind of learned, you know, kind of self-promotion arm. I think it's definitely something that authors sadly need to do now. I don't think, you know, in the past authors were so kind of out there and so self-promoting, but now with so many kind of, it's just a lot of, you're just competing with so many other interests and, you know, you've got to kind of make your name in any way you can. So yeah, you know, you've got to be on Facebook and you've got to be on Twitter and you've got to, you know, kind of let the fans know, you know, what you're about, what your brand is about. But I think if it doesn't come naturally and if it's kind of done in a very marketing perspective, I think, you know, people kind of sense that and it actually turns people off. So either, you know, you're kind of comfortable putting your personality out there, and then if you're not, it might be better to just write the books, you know.
Absolutely. And I would remind everybody here that we're speaking with author Melissa De La Cruz. Melissa DeLaCruz.com is her website, and the book of Serpent's Kiss out right now, second in a Witches of East End novel. So what's kind of coming up in the future? You're gonna kind of do both together, both series? You're going to kind of run together? And then when the Witches of East End, like you said, could be a trilogy but might be further, are you going to do both simultaneously?
With my other series?
With the other one, too. Yeah, you're going to
oh,
are you
yeah.
doing both?
Yeah, I'm doing a bunch of series. Witches of East End is definitely going to be at least a trilogy because I'm writing the third book right now. They actually bought 5 books, but I'm not. I don't know if I'm going to do. Yeah, so we might either do more Witches books or more of something new. And then Blue Bloods is ending with a big finale in January, and then I'm doing a new series, a couple of new series next year. One is a kind of a more kind of full-on sci-fi fantasy series called Frozen, The Otherland Chronicles, which is coming out from Penguin next year. So that's kind of more, like, I'm kind of like creeping into more kind of outright fantasy. So.
And is that kind of the way that you think that your career is going to end up being? It's kind of more along fantasy? Are you going to stay with the YA kind of theme in the fantasy? Are you going to have it more more adult-driven, I guess? Even though YA is still kind of adult. I never really understood that, but I mean, YA is still... Heck, I read freaking comics and I love
right?
YouTube. You know, what the heck? So,
yeah.
But is that where you kind of see yourself going? Is kind of more the fantasy suspense way?
Yeah, I think so. But I think still in the YA market. Frozen is a YA fantasy. And actually, after I wrote, you know, I think a lot of writers, you know, you always want the big adult book, the big, you know, kind of adult attention. And you know, when I wrote Witches, I was like, well, here it is. I'm going to be an adult writer. And I loved writing and I like writing the series, but I also kind of realized that I am a teen writer. I really like writing for young people. I kind of like the YA genre, and that's the one I feel comfortable in. So I think, you know, we'll probably always have a toe in both, but I think at heart I am a YA writer.
Yeah, and that's kind of good that, you know, you figured out like where
mm-hmm.
your voice is and where
yeah.
you're and where you're driving to, because that's, you know, it's very important that you're not kind of like just throwing yourself kind of all over the place
yeah.
and, you know, kind of getting confused. Yeah, and I think that's important. And I think that's something that a lot of authors lose, and maybe that's why they either stop writing or don't really become popular, because they don't really know who they are as a writer yet, and I think that hurts.
Yeah, no, I think you've got to kind of play to your strengths and, you know, kind of write what you love. And, you know, there's a reason I've written 20 YA books. I love writing for teens. I can really get into the mind of somebody who's 14. I remember those years so vividly, and, you know, not just the memories, but the emotions, you know, that come with being, you know, 14, 15, 16. And I always tell people it's wonderful to write about teens because I can write about these boys who steal cars and are rebels and they're just so bad. And, you know, it's wonderful. He's 16, you know, he's so great and sexy. But if he was a 35-year-old stealing cars and doing all that, he'd just be a loser. So.
You know, the other thing that you have on your website, and some authors have done this before, but yours is kind of the most extensive, is your music playlist.
Oh, yes, yes.
And you kind of have a playlist for kind of every book. Now, I have to see, is this the kind of, now, you pick these songs out, of course, yourself. Now, are these the kind of songs that you kind of heard in your head while you were writing that you feel that, okay, read the book, put these songs on behind you, and that's kind of like the whole experience. Or is it more along the lines of, by listening to these songs, you'll kind of have an idea of maybe how the book kind of flows, like from beginning to end, if you set it up that way? How did you set up the playlist?
I set up the playlist, the first kind of thing you mentioned, is just the songs that inspired me while I was writing it. So some of the songs I would listen to and thought about while I was actively writing the books. And a lot of my books do kind of have a musical influence, like two of them actually have titles from songs. One is Misguided Angel, kind of inspired by the song from the Cowboy Junkies, and the other one is Lost in Time, which was also inspired by a song by another band called Stella Star. So I feel like music is, you know, kind of getting in the mood of the books. So they're inspired by them, and then sometimes I also look for songs that kind of, you know, touch on what the characters are feeling. So it's not really about the flow of the book. It's more like something to have on in the background, yeah, while you're reading the book, or something that reminds me of the book.
Yeah, because I'm looking here in the Silver Blood playlist.
Uh-huh.
It's pretty hard. You got Disturbed, you got Ron Zombie, you got Stained,
yeah.
You got some, you know, Smashing Pumpkins, Tool. You got some hard. I mean, your musical listening is quite wide with, you know, Journey and Human League, and I don't think I've ever seen anyone ever put Led Zeppelin and Death Cab for Cutie on the same playlist. I mean, you know, so I just—it's just one of those things. I mean, you're kind of all over with kind of the different music that you kind of listen to.
Yes.
It's quite entertaining. I mean, it's really intriguing. I mean, just looking at it, you can kind of get a glimpse into your mind just from seeing the type of music that you listen to.
Mm-hmm.
Almost.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, I think, and I like a lot of different music. I remember when I went to college, one of the fads was we would make, mixtapes, and we would have some classical music even. Like, you would listen to Madonna, then you would put on Mozart, and then, you know, Elvis Costello, and it was all about the mix and all about kind of, you know, appreciating a lot of different genres of music. So I think I kind of always took that as part of my adulthood, that, you know, you had to be open to everything and, you know, kind of, I do like a lot of different things. I like a lot of different books, a lot of different music.
Yeah, and you kind of do this for every book.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Underworld was good. You started right off with AC/DC and Avenged Sevenfold, you know, and I like both of those bands. So you just kind of come and you do this for every book, and people can kind of listen to it.
Yeah, no, I think it's really fun. It's a way to connect with the fans. You know, they seem to enjoy the playlists a lot. We get a lot of comments about them because we post them on Facebook every Friday. So we call it kind of Blue Bloods or Witches Music Friday. So it'll be, you know, a character playlist, or sometimes a city playlist, the book playlist. I was running out of ideas, but thankfully people are like, well, what about this kind of playlist? They're like, oh, okay, we'll do that.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's good. And that's kind of like the interaction with your
mm-hmm.
fans, that it just gives them, you know, and it gives them that sense of, you know, that you really care about what they think, and it just makes you that much more, you know, popular and entertaining with your fans when you can be able to do those things.
Oh, definitely. I very much care what they think, and I think that's something that authors, you know, should be open to. You know, I mean, it's kind of an ongoing dialogue. I have, you know, because the books have been out for so long and I go on tour every year, you know, I see the same people at the events, and, you know, they become, you know, kind of your friends. You look forward to seeing, oh, I'll see, you know, Katie in Texas, and I'll see, you know, Carrie in LA, and it's an interesting world now.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Melissa, for coming on. It has been fascinating. The book is Serpent's Kiss, out now, the second in Witches of East End novel series. And your website, again, melissa-delacruz.com, to find out anything you want to listen to, read, watch trailers, anything. You got a very extensive website, so people can, you know, be on there for a long time. Just check it out and see, and kind of, you know, a little bit of glimpse into your soul.
Cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been really fun.
Well, thank you, Melissa. Yeah, enjoy yourself, and we look forward to seeing what you got coming out next, and have you on when your next book comes out with the series, and see what's going on after the Blue Bloods. Like you said, you got the finale, and you got a bunch of stuff going on. So very interesting to see what you got going on.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
All right. Bye. So, again, everybody, that was author Melissa De La Cruz with the book Serpent's Kiss. We want to thank all of our guests that have been on today, starting back with Joy Castro and her book Hell or High Water. Then we had John Bearden with his book Let the Devil Sleep. And then John Everson with Nightwear just came on. It's been a very exciting show. We want to thank everybody for listening. We want you to know also that video clips, trailers for your book, excerpts, audio clips we're going to start playing on the website for the show next week. We have some that new that came in that we are producing to get back out. Speaking of next week, we have a fabulous show, again, another two-hour edition coming up with Tess Garrison, John Land, Boyd Morrison, just to name some that are on there. And that's going to start again at 10 o'clock Pacific time, along with author Robert Logan. So we're going to have a very, very jam-packed show next week, and we want to catch everybody. If you want to listen live, listen to the archive, whatever you want to do, check out Suspense Magazine. If you want four free issues, all you have to do is email us at editor@suspensemagazine.com, and we'll put you on the list. You can check out everything that's going on, see your favorite authors, hear what they're talking about, because we bring it all to you also right here on Suspense Radio, but we also bring it to you within Suspense Magazine. Well, the time is up. Again, we want to thank everybody. I'm your host, John Robb. We will see you all next Saturday at 10 a.m. Goodbye, everybody. And again, our hearts go out to everyone in Colorado. We wish you nothing but the best and a very speedy recovery and everything you're going through. So goodbye, everybody, and we'll see you next week.